This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
If the stadium could only talk, for the last time, RFK Stadium, the site of today's match between the Dallas Cowboys and Washington Redskins, another sellout, no surprise there, they've had them since the beginning. RFK Stadium, what a place it is. Pat Summerall here with John Madden, and it's sad in many ways to be a part of the goodbye to this great arena, but it's an honor to be included.
Yeah, it's a real honor, and I think right now there's no place that I would rather be right now than right here at RFK Stadium, and because we've seen so many great players and so many great games here. And
that was Pat Summerall and John Madden, December 22nd, 1996, the day the Redskins played their final game at RFK Stadium. The next fall, they opened up a new stadium in Landover, and things were never and haven't been quite the same. Good morning, everybody. So much to do on this Monday following a Caps win, an NFL draft that produced five new players for Washington, controversy and drama throughout the world of sports all weekend with NBA controversies and crazy endings and Shedeur Sanders getting pranked. But we will carry the press conference at 11 a.m., where Mayor Muriel Bowser, Josh Harris, the owner of the Washington Commanders, and Roger Goodell will be together. Yeah, Roger Goodell will be there as well to announce the deal for RFK at 11 a.m. So keep it here. We'll carry that presser live. We'll carry some of the Q&A that goes on because there are a lot of questions. Real quickly, that was a huge win for the Caps. You know, there were games played this weekend. There were things that are current, not 5 years from now things. What a hit by Tom Wilson early in the third period. Set up that game tying goal. Caps with a big third period, really, for the first time in this series. And they win 5-2 to take a commanding 3-1 lead in this series. They get an extra day before Game 5 Wednesday night at home. But really a big win considering that, you know, for a while, down 2-1 and 0-5 on the power play, which included a two-man advantage for about a minute and a half as well. But they came through in the third period. That hit by Tom Wilson was a game changer for sure. I don't know if it should have been penalized or not. I'm not enough of a hockey guy to know. I know his rep precedes him, and there are a lot of people that thought it should have been or could have been, or they were surprised it wasn't. But, man, what a game-changing play. More on the Caps' big win later on in the show. So the NFL draft is over. Washington had five picks going in. They didn't make one trade, not one. All weekend long, they drafted five players. The class, like last year's class, is very athletic. We'll get into what they got and what we think a little bit this hour, but Cooley, you'll hear from him on the show. He broke down Josh Connerly Jr. And did that on my podcast on Friday, so I'll play about 15 minutes of that. He likes the player a lot. Ben Standing will join us today on the show at 12. Yeah, what a crazy weekend. Max is with me. I mean, I watched a lot of hoops. I'm not going to lie to you. Certainly watched the Caps. Day three of the draft, I had it on. I was certainly following what Washington was doing. I'll tell you, of the three players selected on day three, there is one that I really like a lot, and I'll get to him in a bit. But let's start with, you know, the RFK announcement that is upcoming at 11 a.m. It looks like a go. Now, we learned this, about a week ago when NBC4 broke the news. 2030 is the target. This will be a translucent dome stadium, we're pretty sure. I'm sure we'll hear more about the details of what the stadium will look like during the 11 a.m. press conference. There are still hurdles. You know, this is going to be a very positive, upbeat press conference, and this is a big part of what the mayor has been trying to accomplish. Mayor Bowser has done something here over the last 6 months that will be lasting for her legacy, even though there are more important things. There aren't things that are higher profile or higher exposure than stadiums. Keeping Washington's NBA and NHL team in Chinatown with $515 million of renovation commitment, and then getting the football team back to D.C. after 27 seasons in Maryland with potentially $850-plus million of private and public and taxpayer commitment will certainly be something that she will be remembered for. But there are hurdles. This isn't going to be a done deal when you hear it. I'm sure they will get asked about where the city council is. 12 members currently because of the Ward 8 issue. So they're going to still need 7 out of 12 votes for it to pass. You still have, as it's been explained a couple of times on this show with various guests, you're still going to have zoning challenges. You're going to have the NIMBYs, the not in my neighborhood people. There is a push for a public vote on the ballot for primary season. Those votes typically, when they're voted on by the public, never go well, typically for billionaire owners and cities who want taxpayer dollars for stadiums. So there is still stuff that needs to happen, but it got to at least this point where the city, A, got the land, B, they got a deal done with the team. This was always, I think, the odds-on favorite. Once the land, because they could have done nothing without having the ability have an extended, 100-year lease on the RFK site, the 170-plus acres. And you have a deal between the city, which the city will end up funding a significant part of the infrastructure. The team will build the stadium and the surrounding retail, mixed-use, residential as well, and will benefit from that, I am sure. $3 billion is essentially going to be the price tag, and it looks like, at least for now, and the odds would favor this, that the council will pass and that, those that will push back on this in terms of using taxpayer dollars or using that big parcel of land for a sports stadium. Ultimately, I do think we have the news that we've wanted for a long time. And getting Washington's football team, the Redskins, for all of those years. The Commanders did not play at RFK Stadium, just to be clear. There's been a lot of references to bringing the Commanders home. It's bringing the Washington football franchise home, because the Washington football franchise was the resident of D.C. from 1961 through 1996. Bringing the Commanders to their first home in D.C. is a more accurate way of putting it, but we can move on from that. But it's 5 years away. And what's ironic about all of this is that there is great, I think, happiness among the team's fans. Now, not everybody's thrilled with this. I'm a D.C. resident, and there are many D.C. residents that don't want this. They don't want their taxpayer dollars going to this. But in terms of the team's fan base, overwhelmingly, every poll, every survey, including the team's own internal surveys, have indicated for a long time what we've all known intuitively. And that is, the home of this football team should be in the city, and that RFK site in particular. Not that it'll look anything like what it used to look like nor do we want it to, really. Come on. It is 2025 and 2030 when the stadium will open. And there will be massive events at that stadium from 2030 on. I think, you know, once this gets done, we're 10 years or less away from a Super Bowl. Yeah, you'll get a Super Bowl as long as you have the requisite capacity of 65,000 plus, which it'll have. I don't think it'll be much more than 65,000, and a dome stadium in a cold weather city. They'll never do an outdoor cold weather city Super Bowl again. Not after what happened at Giant Stadium when the weather was cold, but it was clear. But less than 12 hours after the game, they had a foot of snow on the ground. They'll never risk their biggest day for that, especially since by the time we get to a Super Bowl in, say, 2032 or 2033, it'll be happening even later than the Super Bowls happen right now. But the irony of this happening now is that the experience in Landover over 27 years was brutal, except for the last year. And it was brutal first and foremost because a losing team most of the time played in that stadium. Had Dan Snyder never purchased the team and there had been a decent owner, a competent owner that had owned the team all of those years at FedEx Field and produced even a modest amount of winning, you know, a normal amount of winning, because the NFL is designed for every franchise to win occasionally, to have a really good season or two occasionally, to be in the postseason and maybe even win a game or two occasionally. Our franchise didn't do that for 26 years, from 97 through the 2023 season. It couldn't, because it was so poorly run. It was the clown show of all clown shows in sports. And if the team had had winning teams, it would have produced some winning memories and some big-time games, and we wouldn't have hated it as much as we did. But when you combined the losing and the embarrassing losing with a stadium that wasn't very attractive, nor was RFK, with some of the worst traffic issues that they never could figure out. And part of that is just our city and the traffic issues it has and the beltway, you know, where when you have a ton of traffic and it seems like it never ceases, no matter what time of day or night, no matter what day of the week. Seems like Saturday or Sunday. It doesn't matter if there's a game or not a game. There's traffic. But everything about that stadium was unpleasant. But it started with the team. The team wasn't any good. The team was an embarrassment. The stadium became a mark for opposing fans to move in and take over. That started 2007, 2008. Never forget the night the Steelers fans came in for Sunday Night Football and literally took the stadium over. That wasn't a 50-50 deal. That was an 80-20 deal, one way. 80-20, 80 Steelers fans, 20 Washington fans. But it'll be nice to get away from it. But the irony is, after all of those years, now this team looks poised to go on a run. We haven't had a run since the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. There hasn't been a run. There hasn't been a several-year period where the team's been a contender. Teams coming off 14 regular season wins, 16 overall out of, you know, their 21, you know, games played, 20 games played, 14 wins, 6 losses, and an NFC championship loss to the Eagles, in which they were 60 minutes away from advancing to the Super Bowl. They have a quarterback for the first time who looks to be elite. These last 5 seasons, you know, the 25, 26, 27, 28, and 29 seasons at FedEx Field, Northwest Field, excuse me, the stadium in Landover, may be the greatest run of the stadium's history just as it's about to close. We will likely have a lot of really good memories as fans of this team over the final 5 years. I mean, what's the over-under on playoff games that'll be played there? Only four playoff games over 27 seasons were played in Landover. There was a game against Detroit after the 99 season, wild card game. There was a game that was infamous in January of 2013, RG3's injury game against Seattle. There was a game against Green Bay after the 2015 season. Aaron Rodgers came in and beat Washington. And then remember, and this is the one I forgot when we were talking about this about a week ago, is that they had a home game, not that there were any fans there, in 2020 during COVID, when Washington, as a 7-9 division winner, hosted Tampa. Four playoff games in all of those years. 1-3 in terms of their record in those playoff games. What's the over-under on playoff games at Northwest Field over the final 5 years? It's got to be 5.5, 6, 6.5. They're going to play home playoff games. They're going to play playoff games. We know that. Hopefully, plenty of playoff games. There is a real possibility over the final 5 seasons of this stadium, they'll have 5 times the number of meaningful and memorable games than they had in the 27 years that preceded the final five. But this is really good news. It's a long way off, but we'll get to watch the progress together. And let's hope, you know, the hurdles are cleared. I would assume that there is great confidence, and we'll hear that this morning at 11, that they can get the city council to pass this, that they can get the proper zoning, that they can make the pitch, which they have to do. They're going to have to pitch how good this is for the city, the resurrection of that plot of land in particular, which has been a blight. You know, it's been sitting there vacant for so long. And yet, you know, within 2 to 3 blocks of that neighborhood are beautiful neighborhoods and very nice areas. And so they're going to turn something, hopefully, that isn't pretty into something that's great for the city. I'm excited about that as a resident of D.C., to see maybe what was done in Chinatown by Abe Poland be accomplished by Josh Harris and this mayor at the RFK site. But it'll be exciting. We're 5 years away from it, but a big announcement, and I'm sure a lot of questions hopefully answered at 11 a.m. Again, we'll carry that live on the show. All right, I want to come back and talk a little bit about the draft from over the weekend because I know that's important to many of you. We'll go through the 4 picks that have been made since we last did a show here. But on the way out of this segment, there is one of my all-time favorite sort of beginnings of a game at RFK Stadium that I've played so many times on this show over the years. It's one that's available on YouTube. The whole game is. In 1986, Washington and the New York Giants played a game in December of that year at RFK Stadium. They were the two best teams in the league. This was for first place in the NFC East, which would lead to eventually home field advantage throughout the postseason. Now, this was the year the Giants went on to win the Super Bowl, led by Lawrence Taylor in his MVP season. But this gives you a sense of the stadium, the importance of it, the games that were played. This was the league's, not the division, not the conferences, the league's biggest game of the year. And this is how it was introed by Pat Summerall.
Redskins' offensive line is one of football's best, but today their reputation will be challenged by Lawrence Taylor and a fired-up New York defense. The Giants are confidently riding the crest of a 6-game winning streak. And with the right calls from Phil Sims, they hope to roll a 7 today. The Giants Giants also face some stiff challenges today. First, their defense must contain Washington's fleet receivers, like Gary Clark. And their unheralded pass blockers will have to contend with Dexter Manley, one of the best pass rushers in the NFL. Manley relishes the spotlight, and today it shines brightly in the season's biggest game. Joe Morris ran the Giants to victory in their first meeting, but today's rematch is at RFK Stadium, where the Skins are hard to beat and where tickets are impossible to find. CBS Sports presents the National Football League. Today, it's the New York Giants against the Redskins of Washington, live from RFK Stadium, sold out for the 157th consecutive time. And believe me, there is no place to play, no more enthusiastic setup than RFK.
Second down and one for the Hokies. Pop Watson, in his first start, takes the snap, play fake. Looks to throw, fires it deep down the field. He's got his man laying in stride to the 20, to the 10, 5. Touchdown, Tech. It's a 66-yard touchdown pass. And the Hokies, Pop Watson, throws a home run ball all the way to Jalen Lane.
Jalen Lane, wide receiver and punt returner. Yeah, and a really good punt returner. Out of Virginia Tech on day three, fourth round, pick number 128. I'll give you my thoughts on the draft here coming up. This from Oscar. Oscar just wrote me, "Kevin, you got me again. Hearing the voices of John Madden and Pat Summerall at RFK Stadium is nostalgia on steroids. Where can I listen to that again?" Well, you can just download the Odyssey app and listen to the beginning of the show. After the show, but all of those games, a lot of those games are just available on YouTube, like the actual broadcast, the CBS broadcast of some of the biggest games Washington's ever played are just, they're there on YouTube. This from Alan, "Kevin, spine tingled hearing the Summerall Madden RFK highlights. Wow, I can still hear it. I can still see it. I can still smell it." Yeah, Alan, I can too. Like right now, if I focus, I can smell exactly what it smelled like when you walked into RFK Stadium. And yeah, you can feel it. You can see it. I think some of the cool moments, you know, walking up some of those ramps, and our seats were in the upper level. We were in section 513, row 13. So we weren't at the very top, but we were much closer to the top than, you know, the bottom. And we were at about the 10-yard line behind the Skins bench. That's where our seats were. And, you know, walking up those ramps, and occasionally when you would walk by one of the entrance, you know, into the stadium, and you could see the field and you could see the players. That was something incredibly exciting. Not to mention, you know, all of the smells of the stadium, but then all of the smells of just thinking about, you know, smoke. Like, it was pipe smoke back then. It was obviously cigarette smoke. And of course, there was the occasional whiff of weed in the stadium long before it was legalized. But yeah, Alan, I have the same sort of recall in terms of some of the more important senses that we use. And I think a lot of us that spent a lot of time in that stadium for games can feel it and see it and smell it, as you said, like you can as well. It will smell differently, I am sure, because there will be the new stadium smell, which is a great smell. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm talking about. But we're 5 years away from it. Lots of things to get through, but it should be exciting. And again, we're going to carry the press conference with the mayor, with Josh Harris, Washington's owner, and the commissioner will be there as well, Roger Goodell. All right, the draft, since we last talk. Obviously, Washington selected Josh Connerly Jr. at number 29 in the first round, despite many, many offers, according to Adam Peters, to trade back. They clearly liked the player. They clearly wanted the player. The offensive line depth in the draft wasn't there, and so when you got to the end of the first round, there were teams looking to snag their offensive tackle or offensive guard before the really good ones and the ones worthy of a first-round grade got picked. Washington decided to stick, and Josh Connerly Jr., more likely than not, will be the team's starting right tackle when we get to the beginning of the regular season. Is it possible he's not ready? Sure. And in that case, Andrew Wiley or Brandon Coleman will be the starting right tackle. But that was the first pick. We spent a lot of time on Friday talking about that. After that, Washington stuck at every spot where they were scheduled to pick going into the draft. Number 61 in the second round, number 128 in the fourth round, number 205 in the sixth round, and 245 in the seventh round. The second round pick, Trey Amos, corner from Ole Miss, is considered to be, by a lot of people, maybe the best value pick for Washington in terms of where they got him at 61 in the second round and how high he had been projected. He was projected as high as the middle of the first round, but an average projection of late first round, and Washington got him very late in the second round. This was a player who was a starting corner at Ole Miss for just a year, played at Louisiana first, then transferred to Bama, played behind Terrion Arnold, played behind, Kool-Aid McKinstry, and moved to Ole Miss after Nick Saban called it quits and they brought in Kalen DeBoer. And he had his true breakout season last year. An SEC best 16 defended passes. He is incredibly athletic. He's got good size at 6'1", 195. And this is a guy that can play in a lot of different ways defensively. He can play press man. He can play really good zone coverage. This is considered by most to be, in terms of where they got him, the best value pick. No one had Trey Amos going 61 in the second round. Now, we talked about this a lot going into the draft. This was a draft where picks 5 through 50 or 6 through 60 or 7 through 70, whatever, you know, big gap you want to sort of take from the analysts, was a draft in which there wasn't a lot of difference, you know, among the 60 to 70 players in terms of the corners in this draft. You know, you had Travis Hunter, Will Johnson had an injury, Jahdae Barron went, Maxwell Hairston both went in the first round, and then it was about what would happen next. And Washington had an opportunity for a guy that had, you know, been mocked ahead of Jahdae Barron and Maxwell Hairston in several mocks. It's a defensive playmaker. It's a defensive spot. I'm going to say this a lot between now and the time we've seen these guys actually play in an NFL game for an NFL team, that you don't know and I don't know because they don't even know. Now, there are players occasionally where you do know, but they usually reside at the very top of the draft in terms of the true, you know, deep down, test somebody with truth serum about what they know about these players when they get to the next level. They're high on them. They like them. They think that they project to the NFL level, but you never know until you get them into camp, until you get them into games. And you probably see them play a year or two, if not more, worth of games. But Trey Amos was a very good value pick for them. Ran 4.43 in the 40, 6.1, another, and by the way, this was the second straight year. And I meant to mention this before we got into some of the players specifically. The second straight year, Washington had the highest aggregate relative athletic score among its draft choices in the league. That was an emphasis once again. They wanted athletes. Connerly Jr. was a super athletic offensive lineman. Amos ran 4.43 and was super athletic. And then we get to the pick that they made in the fourth round at 128. Wide receiver, Jalen Lane from Virginia Tech. A player who, by the way, is a very good punt returner as well. But in terms of wide receivers heading into this draft, you know, Jalen Lane was a guy that projected anywhere from 10 to 20 on average among the wide receivers. Another really good athlete, ran 4.34 at the combine. Jalen Lane had a career in which he started at Middle Tennessee State, played 3 years there, transferred to Tech in 2023. Ended up in 2 years with about 79 receptions, 8 touchdowns, but also carried the ball a bunch. A lot of jet sweeps, a lot of fly sweeps. They utilized Jalen Lane and his speed, which was exceptional over and over again at Tech. 4.34 he ran in the 40. He's very fast. I think after spending some time watching him more so over the weekend than I did before the draft, I think he's got really good vision. I actually think his vision and his cuts really show up as a punt returner. He averaged 10.8 yards per punt return with 2 touchdowns in college. He also returned some kicks. But I thought his vision as a returner was even at times more consistent and better looking than his open field vision as a pass catcher or as a runner. But what he does have is he's got exceptional kind of acceleration. He's got great speed, but there is that ability to separate once he catches the ball. That is exciting. With that said, he's a bit, you know, small. He's 5'10", 190. So that would be the one knock. But, you know, even reading a little bit about him over the weekend, because you don't get a lot of the blocking in the highlight packages, but in reading about him, he was, as a blocker, a willing blocker. Now, I'll also tell you, as a punt returner, muffed a couple of punts last year for Virginia Tech. Something just to keep in mind. All right, so Jalen Lane, fourth round. My favorite player since we talked on Friday, after spending a bunch of time looking at these players and reading about these players, is Kane Medrano, the linebacker from UCLA that they selected in the sixth round. This is instinctive at the highest levels. You know, the linebacker Carson Schwechinger from UCLA went with the first pick in the second round, higher than most people anticipated. Kane Medrano is 6'3", 222, played primarily linebacker in a 3-3-5, which is a typical college scheme you see across the board. You'll see that 3-3-5. He didn't really play a whole lot in his first 4 years at UCLA, but became a starter in 2023. And this is just a guy that just makes plays. Now, he misses some when he gambles. This is one of those guys that's going to, you know, use his anticipation and his feel and his vision for the game to kind of jump stuff. And sometimes he's wrong. And so that can lead sometimes to missed tackles or to getting beat in coverage. But last year for UCLA, he had 2 interceptions, 1 for a touchdown, and 3 forced fumbles in a season in which he had his best season as a tackler as well. Everything about watching Kane Medrano on tape, and I didn't watch much of him before because linebacker was not necessarily the position we were focused on, but this guy is, as Scott McLuhan would say, he's a football player. Like, he just is an athlete, but it's not just his ability to run, and he ran 4.46 at the combine. It's not his ability on a vertical leap, which, by the way, 38 inches on the vertical. This is a high-level athlete. It's his athletic anticipation that is so impressive to watch. I went back specifically to read what Adam Peters, and it was actually Lance Newmark who did the press conference after the day three picks, because I really wanted to hear what he said after I watched Kane Medrano highlights. And he said, here, a guy that we have a vision for and we're excited about and feel... Oh, he said, Kane Medrano from UCLA is a guy that really kind of is a unique story, where he's got an offensive background and he transitioned himself into a linebacker. Really a cool athlete, tall, long, fast, fastest linebacker at the combine, ran sub 4.5, yeah, ran 4.46. Another guy that has a really unique body type and just a unique athlete in terms of his testing numbers. To me, you can kind of feel his offensive history in his play. I think he has a really good feel as a coverage player, just has a unique sense. As a pass defender, we have a unique situation where linebackers coach Ken Norton Jr. coached him at UCLA, so we had some great insight on what we were getting in terms of the player and the person. Adam Peters and Dan Quinn and I went out to see that UCLA Pro Day in March and had some great conversations about him, and he was another player, I hate to beat a dead horse, but was at the top of our board at the time when we picked, in another one where we just had great buy-in from all sides of the evaluation process. I think when he says he just has a really good feel as a coverage player, just has a unique sense, that's what really, really pops on film for Kane Medrano, is that he's just one of those guys that just has kind of that sixth sense about where the ball is going to be. Like, oh God, why am I blanking on this player? The safety for the Bills for many years. Guy that's played a number of spots around the league. I'll come up with his name shortly, but I always loved him as a player because it wasn't, and by the way, Medrano is much more athletic, and it looks like he could play a number of positions. I'm sure he'll be an outstanding special teams player as well. But, you know, there was one thing that did pop up, and you could see it on tape, is that against some of the higher level teams they played, he just gambled too much and ultimately was out of position to make tackles. He's also an older player. Like, he's 24, I think, going on 25. I liked of their players since we talked Friday, I think he is my favorite of the group. And then they drafted a running back, Jacory Kroski-Merritt from Arizona, although really he didn't really play much for Arizona. He played in one football game against his former school, New Mexico, which is where in 2023 he rushed for 1,100-plus yards and 17 touchdowns. So running back, Jacory Kroski-Merritt. So didn't look at him when I did my running back stuff. He was really way down the list of running backs, in part because he didn't play last year. He played one game for Arizona and then was ruled ineligible because he started his career at Alabama State and played there for four seasons and then played at New Mexico in 2023, then thought he had eligibility, but the NCAA ruled against the eligibility after he played in one game. In that one game, by the way, against New Mexico, the school he played for the year before, 13 carries, 106 yards, and a touchdown. He averaged 8.2 yards per carry. Now, Arizona demolished New Mexico State, although the game was competitive early. I watched a bunch of his highlights from that game. So, by the way, his nickname's Bill. All right, so it's Bill Kroski-Merritt or Bill Merritt, not Bill Marriott, but Bill Merritt. But Jacory Kroski-Merritt is impressive on tape, man. He is one of those dudes who, you know, he's 5'10", 205. He ran 4.45. He actually looks 4.45 on the field. He is explosive. He has good vision. Now, you know, he's one of those guys where the games in which he had big games weren't always against the best opponents. Let me just I'll pull up the game log from New Mexico in particular, where he had some massive games at the end of 2023. All right, hold on for 1 second. I'll pull it here. So he had in 2023 for New Mexico, all right, he had his final two games against Fresno and Utah State, 21 for 209 in two touchdowns, 31 for 233 in a touchdown. So in two games, he went 52 for 442 yards and three touchdowns. But against the likes of Boise, UNLV that year, they were a very good defensive team. They played early in the year, Texas A&M. You know, the results were much different. He was down well below, you know, 5 yards per carry, but still competitor, and, you know, and looks the part. You know, we'll see. I kind of felt like Washington needed an all down back, you know, not necessarily for this year all down, because if you assume Eckler and Debo will get some of the all down stuff. But, you know, a guy that could go in there first and second down. And to me, he looks more change of pace. But you can't get it all, you know, with five picks in the draft. And that leads me to this. You know, the biggest surprise, clearly the biggest surprise, is that Washington did not end up with an edge defensive end. You know, we spent a lot of time looking at all of the edges, all of the defensive ends, and they didn't take any of them. You know, there were as many edges and defensive tackles picked in this draft as any other position. You know, they had opportunities, obviously, in the second round. You know, Mike Green went long before, you know, they came up at 61, and Oladehu and Scorton and my guy JTT from Ohio State, he went much earlier than projected to the Colts early in that round. Ezeraku went early in that round to Dallas. Then when you got to the fourth round at 128, the guy Kyle Kennard was a possibility, but they went wide receiver. You had a lot of edge defensive ends selected in this draft. I think edges and defensive ends were right at the top in terms of players drafted, and Washington didn't come away with one. To me, that's the biggest surprise, is that they did not get an edge defensive end. And, you know, we'll see if maybe they just like what they have and what they were able to add during the offseason, you know, more than we did, which means more than what we think. I think they think Wise is a pass rusher. I think in year two, they believe Armstrong can really step it up. I think Kinlaw is versatile, and they'll play him on early downs, maybe outside. We'll see. I've always felt, based on something that was told to me at one point during last summer, is that Javonte Jean-Baptiste, their seventh rounder from last year, was a player they really had high hopes for. But ultimately, you know, on defense, in terms of the draft and the offseason so far, Trey Hendrickson hasn't been traded yet. It's the biggest mystery. Biggest mystery. You know, I'm not hashtagging let Adam cook. I mean, some of that's just absurd when it comes to the draft, that you have no idea on what they drafted and what these players will be at the professional level for a couple of years. I mean, we were surprised last year, certainly, that Sanders still turned into as good of a player as he did right away. And you would hope that for Trey Amos, you know, another corner in the second round, that you could end up with a guy with some size and length who can run and is athletic, that he ends up being a big-time outside corner to pair with Marshawn Lattimore, and you can move Sanders still inside in terms of the longer long-term plan. We shall see. But this offseason, if it's over, and it's never over, there are still players out there who are free agents. There are going to be players released or cut or attempted to be traded. And then, of course, we get to the period at the end of training camp. But overall, you know, I'm not into grading drafts. But overall, it was another athletic class, and I really like Kane Medrano's tape. He may never play for them. Who knows? But, man, what an instinctive anticipation athlete he is. And I could certainly see him at the very least being a big contributor on special teams. And I certainly like Jalen Lane as a potential punt returner. You know, they could use a punt returner as long as he can hold on to the ball. All right, the press conference, Mayor, Commissioner, Josh Harris coming up. We'll carry it live.
All right. This morning, D.C. Mayor's office, Muriel Bowser, and the Washington Commanders have announced a deal to bring them back to the RFK site. More specific details will be announced at the joint press conference. You can hear that in just about 10 minutes here on the Team 980. The Caps got the big win in Montreal last night by a score of 5-2. They bring home a 3-1 series lead. Andrew Mangiapane scored the game-winning goal. They will meet again on Wednesday at Capital One Arena. Coverage at 6:45 on 106.7 The Fan. The Nats with two walk-off wins this weekend. Yesterday, beating the Mets on a throwing error that allowed Luis Garcia to reach first, and C.J. Abrams sprinted in from second to lift the Nats over the Mets 8-7. They close out the series today at 4:05. Pregame starts at 3:35 on 106.7 The Fan. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980 and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.